Wine has been an important part of life and culture and food for over 8 millennia. It didn't always taste the way it does now, and while the basic chemistry of wine hasn't changed much, where and how it's made has changed a lot over the centuries. For this week's Food Fridays, Please Explain, we are finding out more about the long history of wine. And joining us is Paul Lucas, the author of a number of books on the subject, including his latest, Inventing Wine, which is published by Norton. Welcome to our show.
It's delightful to talk to you.
We also invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can call us with questions at 212-433-9692 or write us on our show page at WNYC.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Paul, what do we know about when the first wine was invented?
As best we know, and this knowledge is seemingly changing year by year, but as best we know, wine first originated in what geographers or historians would call Transcaucasia, which would be present-day Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, northern Iran, near the in between the Caspian and the Black Seas, roughly 8,000 years ago.
Now, it's interesting that it's in that area because just recently there was news that a skull from what is now Georgia was found, and it dates back 1.8 million years, a human skull. So there's been a lot of human activity in that area for a long time. Is there archaeological evidence that can reveal that wine was being drunk in that area?
Yes, this is all done through archaeology. And the evidence of it is residue of wine found on shards of broken pottery. These Neolithic people at that time were some of the first people who had mastered the art of firing clay and making pots or bowls or vessels. And few of them exist intact, but there are shards of them which have been found that have residue of wine on them.
Why was it seen by the earliest cultures as something created by the gods?
That's really interesting, and it lasted for a very long time. And I think the answer is that wine, unlike any other alcoholic drink, and the only other alcoholic drink people had back then was beer. They had mead, which is arguably honey wine. But wine is produced naturally. That's to say, if you have barley, you can't just take the barley and put it on a table and produce beer. You have to cook it. But wine, if grapes, ripe grapes, fall off the vine onto the ground, they will start making wine of their own. So this looked like it was directly a gift or a present to humankind coming from the gods. And if one consumed this stuff, one felt different.
Because of the alcohol.
Because of the alcohol.
Now, why?
They had no knowledge of what alcohol was. They just knew that unlike water from a well or milk from a goat or a cow, this made you feel different.
So there was a spontaneous fermentation, and at a certain point, I'm assuming, humans figured out ways to make it happen.
Absolutely. And that happened relatively quickly. By the time we're 7,000 years ago, there are vineyards in that area, in eastern Turkey, in ancient Babylon, all around the Fertile Crescent, there are people who are deliberately growing grapes to make wine.
What are some of the earliest references to wine in literature or in art?
There are representations of wine of wine making on, again, going way back, the Hittite culture, ancient Assyria, on pottery and such. The first recognizable references to wine that sort of have lasted into our culture are from ancient Greece, in Homer, for example, in ancient Crete, and then, of course, in classical Athens. By the time you get to there, wine is everywhere.
Now, you mentioned beer. Did people start making beer before they started making wine?
From the evidence we have, wine is older, but not by much. I can't give you an exact date here because this is all, as I say, the archaeological evidence changes depending on who's digging where when. but beer is slightly younger than wine, but it too is quite old.
Now, the earliest wines couldn't be preserved the way we can preserve them now, so I'm assuming it had a relatively short shelf life.
It had a very short shelf life, but it was consumed all year round, which means that it would have tasted very different from the wine that we enjoy today. There was no way to, they didn't have stoppers, they didn't have corks, they didn't have screw caps, they didn't have bottles. They had jars that they might put some kind of grasses or reeds on the top of, but oxygen still came in and the wine would oxidize. So that wine wasn't really valued for its flavor so much as wine was valued for the social and cultural roles that it would play.
And when it when they left it too long, did it turn to vinegar, or is there something different in the process of making vinegar?
It turned pretty vinegary. There's no doubt about that. And one thing that before long a lot of ancient wine cultures did was they wanted to have the wine be as sweet as possible so that they would pick the grapes for their best wines, their most valuable wines, and they would let those grapes dry out in the sun and become essentially raisins, and then crush them and make the wine out of that. So that gave the wine somewhat longer life, and it also made the wines very sweet.
Isn't there evidence that the earliest wines often included tree resins? Why would they have done that? It sounds disgusting. Wouldn't that have affected the taste?
It certainly did affect the taste. If you've ever drunk Greek Resina, you're going to get the modern version of that. In the ancient days, the tree resin was used as a preservative. It was used as a preservative by ancient doctors, too, who would, if you had a wound, they would put tree sap from pine trees on the wound to help the wound heal. They would put tree sap resin from pine and yew trees in the wine to help it, as a preservative, to help it last longer. But this invariably changed the taste of the wine and made it very sappy and pine salt tasting, and to our palate, not very attractive.
On the other hand, wine has alcohol in it. They could have used that, put that on wounds as well. I was wondering, when people were unsure of whether water was safe to drink, could they put wine in it, expecting bad bacteria to be killed off?
Absolutely, and wine was, especially when human society began to become urbanized and people began to live in towns and villages and then cities where the water was invariably unsafe to drink, as opposed to living in the country where one might have a well. In the cities or towns or villages, wine was often used to sanitize the water.
My guest is Paul Lucas, L-U-K-A-C-S, author of a number of books on wine. He's also a James Beard Clicquot and IACP award winner and a professor of English at Loyola University of Maryland, where he directs the university's Center for the Humanities. His latest book is called Inventing Wines, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In looking at the archaeological evidence, we have any sense of how high the alcoholic levels would reach?
We can only make an educated guess, and the educated guess would be that the alcohol levels were relatively low because the grapes probably were picked before they were at the ripeness levels that we pick grapes today, because when the grapes get fully ripe, birds eat them, rot comes, and farmers would be likely to pick the grapes sooner than they would pick them today. But for the wines, the special wines that were raisined, the alcohol levels would be quite high.
Now, when I think of ancient wines, what comes to mind for me is ancient Greece and Rome and the cults of Dionysus in Greece and Bacchus in Rome. Did the Greeks and the Romans take wine to heart in a way that other ancient cultures had not?
I don't think that they took wine to heart more than some other ancient cultures, but I think we know a lot more about them, that we don't know that much about the Hittite culture, or we don't know that much about Neolithic Transcaucasia. We have very little archaeological evidence. We have a lot more evidence and a lot, and we have written texts about what happened in classical Greece and what happened in Imperial Rome. But that the basic notion that wine is something sacred, which is all bound up with the Bacchus and Dionysus myths, that notion is something that had persisted for thousands of years.
Now, if it was sacred, was it reserved for the elite, or did everyone get to take it?
That's a great question. And it's classical Greece, which is the first place where wine becomes part of daily life or general life for the population as a whole. In the pharaoh's Egypt, for example, wine was reserved for the priests and the pharaohs and essentially the nobility.
And it wasn't wine found in King Tutankhamun's tomb in clay jars that actually had labels?
Yes.
And what did the labels say? Sauvignon Blanc?
They wouldn't list the grape variety, but they would list the vineyard and they would list the person who made the wine. So this would be a wine from the vineyard such and such and made by this particular person. But the interesting thing that about the wines that are found in King Tut's grave is that it's further evidence of how people thought of wine in this sacred sense. Wine wasn't something that one drank all the time on earth. It was what one took with, what the king, the pharaoh, took with him to the afterlife where he would drink it with, presumably, the gods.
When did the regions we associate with great wines now, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, I guess we could say earlier Hungary, when did they start making wines?
In many of those places, they started making wine with the influence of the Greeks, but even more the influence of the Roman Empire. But those wines were much like the ancient wines, the ancient Roman wines, were not at all like the wines we associate with them today. When is the beginning of, for example, wine in Burgundy that would have some resemblance to what we think of as Burgundy, or wine in Tuscany that would have some resemblance to what we think of as Chianti? And the answer to that is in the late Middle Ages going into the Renaissance.
Now, didn't Christianity help spread wine drinking and grape growing? In many cases, weren't the winemakers mostly people in monasteries?
Christianity played a really important role in promoting wine culture throughout, especially Northern Europe, where it largely had not been before monks and priests and Christian missionaries came trying to convert the people who had invaded Rome. But the interesting thing about that, it's not that they brought wine as a sacred drink to these people. They brought wine instead as a form of social bonding. The early Christian church did not have wine as part of the Eucharistic ritual that the lay population participated in. Wine was something that was reserved for the priest, so you didn't need to have a lot of wine for the newly converted Christians. What you needed wine for was to say the church is something that you want to belong to. You want to be a part of this community in a social, secular sense more than in a religious one.
Who was growing the grapes? Were they regular farmers?
They would be regular farmers. They would be people who worked for the monasteries. They would be people who worked for the bishop or who worked for the priest, or there would be farmers in that area. And by the time you get into the Middle Ages, and especially the late Middle Ages, there's a booming trade in wine going up and down the Rhine River, for example, or down the Rhone, or in the Saone River, and people transporting wine really throughout Western Europe.
And you say winemaking was a city business in many places.
Wine, one of the sort of interesting paradoxes of wine is that wine, of course, is an agricultural product, but wine is something that we value, and think of in a distinct cultural sense has always been much more of an urban phenomenon.
Well, you mentioned the Rhone Valley, and one of the most famous wines from that area is Châteauneuf de Pape, the ninth castle of the Pope. Popes summered in that area, didn't they? Were they selling those wines, or was that simply for them and the other members of the higher clergy?
Well, when the papacy split and there was one pope in Rome and one pope in Avignon, there was a boom in wine production in the area. The Vatican in those days was perhaps even more centrally oriented than the Vatican these days, and people drank a great deal of wine, but they also sold it because they made more than the Pope and his attendees could drink.
My guest is Paul Lucas. His latest book, Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures, it's published by Norton. We will continue our conversation. Invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle on Twitter is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with more right after this. And we are back with Paul Lucas, whose book, Inventing Wine, A New History of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures, is published by W.W. Norton. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We're talking about wine on today's Please Explain. And I have lots of questions, but let's go to a couple of the calls first. Our first caller is Judy from Westchester. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Leonard. It's I'm calling to add the observation that in the ancient world, in the Hebrew Bible, wine is all over the place. The first reference that I can think of is that after the ark landed, Noah got out, let the animals out, and planted a vineyard and got drunk. And then later on...
Well, he knew it was important.
He did. Of course, he got into trouble for it as well. But
which, by the way, Mr. Lucas, brings up another issue. We've been talking about the spread of wine culture to some degree through the Catholic Church. But there are some religions that think wine is the drink of the devil.
Well, the most obvious example of this is the Muslim faith. But what's interesting about the Muslim faith in the Quran is that it's not that wine is necessarily the drink of the devil. It's that wine is too special for people to drink on earth. The images of heaven in the Quran are filled with descriptions of people drinking, the souls of the dead, drinking wine in the afterlife. But on earth, wine carries with it the danger of drunkenness and intoxication and bad behavior. So it's too good, really, for you to deal with as a fallible mortal person. Once you have gone to the heavens, then you can drink all the wine you want.
Now, some of the wine regions in France were actually settled by the Greeks and the Romans because they... were looking for good places to grow wine grapes?
They were looking for good places, but more to the point, they had settlements there, especially the Romans, and they had their legions there, their army brigades, and they needed wine. So it was much more economically viable to plant vineyards and make wine there than to ship it all the way from Italy, from Rome.
But aren't some areas less conducive to making wine than others? When the Romans went to England, did they have to import their wine?
When they went pretty far north, they had to import their wine. Evidence is that climate was generally a little warmer back then, and there is evidence of wine production in the British Isles, in the southern British Isles, going back to the Roman days.
Bordeaux and Burgundy are still among the greatest winemaking regions in the world. When did they start setting themselves apart from other grape-growing areas?
wine had been made in the areas for a long time. Burgundy starts setting itself apart in the late Middle Ages through the work of the Cistercian monks who plant vineyards in what we now think of as the Côte d'Or or the Golden Slope, where the most famous, most prestigious Burgundies come from. And Bordeaux starts setting itself apart a little later in the 17th century or so, when the beginning of the what we call the chateau system arrives, and properties like Lafitte and Haubrion and Margaux begin to be established.
Chateau means castle, so there would be a castle and then vineyards around the castle?
Well, the interesting thing is there were no castles. The castles only emerge in the 19th century for the most part, and they are very modern, at the time, very modern buildings that are designed to look like sort of fairy tale versions of the past and to impart a sort of false sense of tradition that it's a great marketing tool and enables the Bordeaux producers to sell their wine for more money than they could otherwise.
So chateau in the earliest days just simply was another way of saying vineyard?
Well, it was a specifically Bordeaux designation, and it emerges in the 19th century. There were these castle-like structures built, but they were not historic castles. They were 19th century creations. They were like the Disneylands of the day. But they connoted a sense of tradition, and that sense of tradition was used by the Bordeaux producers to market their wine as something that has real value.
When did grape growers begin growing different varieties of grapes for different kinds of wines and also specializing? So you get Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays in Burgundy, you get Cabernet Sauvignon and Sauvignon Blanc in Bordeaux, and et cetera, Syrahs in the Côte du Rhône, Grenaches. Did they find these, were these grapes indigenous to the areas?
In some cases they were indigenous. In some cases they were mutations of existing grape varieties, because vinifera wine grapes, wine varieties mutate very easily. In some cases they were imported from neighboring regions. But it's really in the late Middle Ages Renaissance that producers who have, winemakers, vintners who have a real sense of trying to make something distinctive begin to focus on using this grape as opposed to another grape. Before then, people made wine largely about with whatever grapes they had growing.
Peg left this question on our show page. How were all the different wine yeasts developed?
Well, the yeasts are natural. The yeast are living in the vineyards. And it is only recently, it's only a 20th century phenomena, that people would cultivate yeast in laboratories and use those in wineries. And before then, all the yeasts were indigenous to the vineyards in which the grapes were growing, and you would harvest the grapes, and then you would crush the grapes, and the fermentation would begin with the yeast that are naturally on those grapes.
Same thing happened with bread making.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the same.
When did the concept of terroir become associated with winemaking?
Well, terroir is a really sort of controversial issue in the world of wine. It is... The notion of a wine from a specific place having a specific character or personality, if you will, goes back to ancient Rome, but really gets going in medieval Burgundy and medieval Germany. But the word terroir doesn't exist and isn't used to talk about wine really until the 20th century. It's only in the mid-20th century that people begin to say, I want this wine to taste like previous wines from this place.
Did the invention of glass bottles help in that regard?
The invention of glass bottles and corks with which to seal the glass bottles, which happens in the late 17th and 18th centuries, is really probably the biggest technological advancement in the 8,000-year history of wine, because it enabled wine for the first time ever, to not spoil rapidly.
Well, now we have screw-top bottles, which some winemakers will tell you is perfectly fine, although many consumers aren't so sure. Does a screw-top work as well as a cork?
Screw-top works just as well as a cork. There are some differences, but in terms of preventing spoilage, the screw-top is even better than a cork because absolutely no air gets in.
Well, isn't air getting in part of the aging process?
This is highly debatable in the contemporary world of wine. That does a premium wine that is closed with a screw cap, will it age as well as a premium wine that is closed with a cork? And there are different people who have done different trials who will give you different answers to that. So I don't really have I don't think there is a definitive answer to that. The Australians, for example, who really believe in screw caps, have been doing trials with their most prestigious wines, like Penfolds Grange, for decades now under screw cap, and they will insist to you that the wines age and develop just as well under screw cap as under cork. The bigger issue with screw caps and cork are the wines that have faulty corks and there's cork taint in the wine, which happens with anywhere between 2 or 3% and 9 or 10% of wine, which is a pretty unacceptable number for a faulty product.
When did aging wine in specially made oak barrels become the norm?
Wine was stored in wooden barrels going way back, going certainly as far back as some in the Roman days and certainly all through the Middle Ages until now. Choosing specific barrels for specific wines and having an oak aging regimen, if you will, only begins for some of the most prestigious wines in the 19th century.
And some of them are even charred a bit, aren't they?
All barrels are charred because planks of wood from a tree don't bend that way. The only way you get them to bend is by heating them over an open flame.
So does that add to the taste of the wine?
That's definitely, that's the sense of, if we talk about a Chardonnay that has oaky flavor having a kind of vanilla or butterscotch quality, that all comes from the charring of the wood, not from the wood in and of itself.
Now, how many times can a barrel be used?
A barrel can be used multiple vintages, but each time it's used, it will impart less and less flavor.
Can we talk? Go ahead.
So that there are really two reasons to store wine in wood as opposed to stainless steel or concrete or some kind of neutral container. One is to have the flavor of the charred wood, and the other is to allow for a small amount of oxidation because wood, unlike stainless steel or concrete or fiberglass, is porous. So if you use a very old barrel, you'll have the oxidation effect, but you won't have the flavor of the wood. If you use a new barrel, you'll have both effects.
Now, we've run out of time, so we can't get to things like the wine regions of other countries, especially the United States. I did want to ask you whether champagne is another one of those naturally occurring inventions.
Well, champagne was a deliberate human invention, which starts in the late 17th, 18th century.
But the reason I ask is I know that the bubbles just occur in cold weather, and then people realize, well, boy, this is a good idea. But we've run out of time. Unfortunately, Paul Lucas is the author of a number of books on wine. The one we've been talking about is Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures, published by Norton.